Thank you very much, Senator. We're thrilled to be here, and we appreciate your hospitality here in Springfield. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Adams. I'm an attorney at the Chicago-based litigation boutique Eimer Stahl, and I'm also president of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter for Chicago. On behalf of the Chicago Federalist Society Board, I'd like to welcome you all to the land of Lincoln. Today's inaugural Federalist Society Midwestern Conference has been years in the making, as we heard from Lisa this morning. Lisa mentioned a few names, and if you please would just bear with me for just one moment, I'd like to really underscore all the hard work that has been years in the making to lead to today. And let me first mention Lisa and Jana of the Federalist Society. I'd also like to thank Eric Wesson and Ryan Schimmerhorn. They are the chairs of the Midwestern Federalist Society Conference. Mark Bremer of the St. Louis Federalist Society, Joey Ashbrook of the Cincinnati Federalist Society, Anthony Sanders of the Institute for Justice, who put on such a wonderful Lincoln Douglas Tavern debate last night that we all had so much fun at. Thank you so much, Anthony. And of course, all of our speakers and panelists. And I recognize for our speakers and panelists, some of whom were not able to make it, that they had to travel from all over the country, from Arizona to Washington, D.C. and Texas, and it took planes, trains, and cannabis-smelling Ubers to get here to Springfield, and we appreciate all that hard work for you to be with us today. The conference today is also the latest event in a series of significant and balanced discussions hosted by the Federalist Society about the most pressing legal issues that we face today. In just a few weeks, for example, on Saturday, May 14th, the Chicago chapter, in conjunction with the Federalist Society, will host our inaugural in-house counsel symposium event in Chicago with Attorney General Bill Barr as our keynote. He will be joined with general counsel and senior lawyers from great American companies such as Amazon, Caterpillar, Citadel, Citigroup, Meta, Walmart, and many others. We hope that you can join us on Saturday, May 14th for our inaugural in-house counsel symposium. Last week marked two momentous events in the life of Abraham Lincoln. First, on April 16th, 1862, after Supreme Court mischief in Dred Scott and other anti-canonical cases, President Lincoln signed into law the D.C. Emancipation Act that immediately emancipated all slaves within the district. This act was the first true emancipation under federal law. It also served as a blueprint to other crucial developments to cleanse our nation of slavery and its evil effects, including the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments to the Constitution. The second event occurred on April 15th, 1865, as we just heard from the Senator, when John Wilkes Booth assassinated our 16th president. After Lincoln drew his last breath on that date, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, sitting by Lincoln's side, uttered to those around him with great sadness, "Now he belongs to the ages." Those words were so prophetic. Since childhood, we have all learned about Lincoln, and today we stand adjacent to a magnificent library dedicated to helping us better understand his life and his legacy. Also better helping us to understand his life and legacy are premier scholars from around the world. These scholars have dedicated part of their professional lives to, as Lincoln said long ago, ensure that we all protect a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. At the very top of a small group of elite constitutional scholars is Professor Kurt Lash. Professor Lash teaches and writes about constitutional law at the University of Richmond School of Law. He is a giant in the academy, as we heard his name referenced repeatedly on today's morning panel. Professor Lash is also a giant in modern-day application of timeless constitutional principles. Last year, for example, he was cited by the Supreme Court in United States against Madero. And as I understand from Professor Werman and Professor Burnick from this morning, he was also cited yesterday by the Supreme Court, along with Professor Burnick and Werman. He has published acclaimed books, including The 14th Amendment and the Privileges and Immunities of American Citizenship. He is an elected member of the American Law Institute and has published numerous law articles in top journals from across the country. I also understand, Professor Lash, that this conference might be somewhat of a homecoming for you. At one point in his illustrious career, he directed the University of Illinois College of Law program in constitutional theory, history, and law. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Kurt Lash.
Thank you, John. Senator, it is just an extraordinary honor to be here. Let's see if I can get my tech in order. I understand there was some announcements in that first panel this morning that I would be continuing the discussion of the Privileges or Immunities Clause for lunch. I can assure you that is not going to happen. I think our wonderful discussants this morning did quite well. It's interesting that there's so much argument. I do have my own position on it, but the scholarship on Section 1 and on the Privileges or Immunities Clause and equal protection and due process is just exploding. And there's new research being done. There's new documents are available. I've published a collection of documents on the Reconstruction Amendment debates. But it's exploding because courts and lawyers and justices are increasingly using the methodologies of originalism and just the methodologies of being attentive to our constitutional history. I've spent many years now speaking to law students at Federal Society chapters around the country, but I've found myself increasingly addressing lawyers as well, because this is becoming much more a part of the standard practice of constitutional law in the United States. I find that to be very welcome, and very welcome to have that concurrence by Justice Thomas yesterday, and in which he cites, I think, almost every major originalist in the country. He gave us a lot of love, and we really, really appreciate that. But again, it's a signal. It's a signal to lawyers to bring those discussions, to bring the ideas of the founding and also the history of the Reconstruction Amendments into your briefs and into your arguments in representing clients. It's a new time, and it's a new time of taking our words, our constitutional words, seriously. It's a welcome event. This is, in fact, John's right, this is kind of a homecoming for me. I did spend several years up the road at the University of Illinois. I gotta tell you, I just really, really miss those monthly tornado warning test sirens. I still remember driving into Urbana with my family a few years ago on this beautiful sunny first Tuesday of the month, and getting out at a gas station and hearing these sirens go off in a blue sky. My wife and I looked at each other just like, well, we don't know a lot about tornadoes. Maybe they can happen in clear weather. We got to know our basement very well that year, and I actually grew to love the dramatic weather that sweeps across the plains. And more I found myself getting out at night and enjoying the starry skies that are just unique in this part of the country. It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place to be. And my son, one of my children, still lives here in Bloomington. And that's where I'll be heading off to celebrate his birthday here momentarily. But now I live in Richmond. I live in Richmond, Virginia, and we have severe storms in Richmond, mainly of the historical variety. Our storms primarily have to do with old Confederate statues and schools named after Confederate military heroes. Most of those statues have now come down, and most of the names have been changed. We have new statues now, including one of Abraham Lincoln and his son, Tad. It's right next to the old Tredegar Iron Works, which is now the new Civil War Museum near downtown Richmond. And as I think many of you already know, Lincoln came to Richmond on April 4th, 1865, 2 days after the Confederate forces had left, had evacuated Richmond, and about a week before Lee surrendered at Appomattox. And Lincoln walked the streets with his son, and he was greeted by cheering crowds of formerly enslaved Black Americans. And his visit was just extraordinarily brave, and it was also an extraordinary symbol of reconciliation. It signaled the beginning of the end, right? Lee would surrender a few days later. Richmond and Virginia would soon be restored to the Union. The 13th Amendment at that point was in the middle of being ratified. Slavery would end, and the nation would be rebuilt. Lincoln himself, however, would not live. He would not live to play a direct role in that rebuilding. Less than 2 weeks after he visited Richmond, Lincoln, of course, died of an assassin's bullet. And historians have wondered ever since what would have happened, what might have happened if Lincoln had actually lived to guide the country through the years of Reconstruction. And it's one of our greatest national tragedies that, of course, he did not. But even if the man died, I think that Lincoln's ideas about the Constitution and about the Union lived on. And I'm going to make some claims this afternoon that those ideas ultimately helped shape Reconstruction, the Reconstruction of the American Constitution. And those ideas involved more than simply the expansion of individual liberty, though they did include such an expansion. What Lincoln and the Republicans sought to achieve was not a replacement of the original Constitution, but a strengthened, reconstructed version of the American Constitution. To Republicans like Lincoln, it had been the seceding South that had betrayed the Constitution of the Founders, and the Republicans had no desire to alter the basic structure of that Constitution. Instead, they wanted to fulfill what they believed was the vision of the Founders all along. That vision included the end of slavery, the protection of the rights of national citizenship, and the equal protection of the natural right not to be wrongly deprived of life, liberty, or property. All of this was to be achieved under the umbrella of a Federalist Constitution. Lincoln and the Republicans believed in federalism just as much as they believed in freedom. In fact, as counterintuitive as it might seem, the only reason we have this amendment, this five-sectioned 14th Amendment, is because moderate Republicans maintained their belief in federalism and limited enumerated national power, even after Reconstruction proceeded. This same combination of federalism and freedom should inform our understanding of all three of the Reconstruction amendments, but especially the 14th. And I plan on taking about 30 minutes or so to try and explain why I think that's the case. And then perhaps if we have time, we can open things up for a general discussion. Let me begin, however, by quoting what might otherwise seem to be a couple of historical oddities, okay? The first is the Republican platform of 1860. The second is going to be a speech by a member of Congress in 1867. Now consider the language of this party platform of 1860. I think it's referenced also in one of the panels there on the wall. Resolved that the maintenance of the principles promulgated in the Declaration of Independence is essential to the preservation of our Republican institutions, and that the federal Constitution, the rights of the states, and the union of the states must and shall be preserved. Now notice this combination, a combination of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and American federalism. To antebellum Republicans, these words and ideas were inextricably bound together. Now, let's consider the second example. This was delivered by a Republican on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1867. It occurred while the 14th Amendment was before the states for ratification. "Sir," the speaker announced, "I'm not to be thus driven into a violation of the letter and spirit of the Constitution of the country. Under it, the rights of the states are as sacred as those of the nation. Its express provision is that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The equality of the states and the equality of men in the rights of persons before the law is what the Constitution enjoins and the people demand." Once again, you have this remarkable combination of federalism and freedom. And this Republican speaker wasn't just any Republican. It was Ohio Representative John Bingham, the primary draftsman of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. And however surprised you might be to see Bingham's commitment to federalism and the 10th Amendment, you might be even more surprised to learn that Bingham delivered this speech as part of his effort to save the 14th Amendment. I'll explain how this came about in a moment. But first, I just want you to ponder these two high-profile Republican declarations before we take the deep dive into history. These two statements represent a vision of constitutional liberty that combines the natural rights announced in the Declaration of Independence, the equality of rights of all persons, and the rights of the states as declared in the 10th Amendment. Republicans both before and after the Civil War did not see these as contradictory principles. They saw them as complementary principles. And explaining how both federalism and freedom came to form the foundation of Republican constitutional theory, however, requires us to go back to the beginning. So, okay, let's go back to the beginning. And if you're going to go back to the beginning, you go back to James Madison. All right. Madison in Federalist 39 talked about the proposed Constitution as being neither wholly national nor wholly federal. It was a combination of both. Major powers were given to the national government, but all non-delegated powers remained under the control of the people in the states. Madison further explained in Fed 45, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain to the state governments are numerous and indefinite. This implicit principle of limited national power in constitutional federalism, of course, was expressly declared by the 10th Amendment. In the Bill of Rights. In fact, the entire Bill of Rights originally represented constitutional federalism. The amendments bound only the federal government and not the states. That meant that states retained the rights of local self-government when it came to subjects like speech and religion and due process. Of course, the federal structure of the original Constitution also allowed states to make their own decisions regarding the practice of chattel slavery. What the people sometimes forget, however, is that American constitutional federalism is a two-sided coin. While constitutional federalism allowed the southern states to maintain pre-colonial British institutions like slavery, it also allowed the northern states the autonomy to abolish slavery. States like Pennsylvania were moving towards abolition even before the Revolution, and by the time of the federal constitution, several northern states had abolished or were in the process of abolishing slavery. The result, then, was a nation of states regionally divided between slavery and abolition. That regional divide, of course, generated regional conflict as the northern states increasingly moved against slavery and southern states increasingly demanded the national protection of slavery. Pro-slavery advocates initiated the gag rules that prohibited Congress from receiving northern state petitions against slavery, and they convinced the federal government to purge abolitionist literature from the national mail. They demanded that northern states respect the Fugitive Slave Acts, and they insisted that slavery be extended into the territories. These advocates of slavery had no interest in federalism and the freedom of each state to make its own policies regarding abolition or slavery. They insisted on a nationalist approach to slavery and pro-slavery as national policy. Northern states, on the other hand, embraced the principles of constitutional federalism and the 10th Amendment, and they insisted that this federalism protected their right to resist the Fugitive Slave Acts, to pass personal freedom laws, protected the rights of their citizens, including abolitionist citizens, to travel throughout the United States, and the right to publish literature and give speeches calling for a ban on slavery in the territories. Abolitionist Republicans cited James Madison and the Federalist Papers as part of their constitutional argument that pro-slavery southern states were actually the ones seeking to subvert the original Federalist structure of the American Constitution. Lincoln, in his famous speech at the Cooper Institute, warned that the slave power would not rest until it extinguished the right of the northern states to adopt the policies of freedom. Lincoln also embraced the standard Republican claim that even if states could make their own policy on slavery, slavery itself should be banned in the territories. So let's talk about that for just a minute. Abolitionists like Frederick Douglass insisted that the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment obligated the federal government to prohibit chattel slavery in the territories. Even if black Americans were not citizens, they were persons who had been deprived of life, liberty, and property without any process whatsoever. Republicans believed that the Due Process Clause was nothing less than the constitutionalization of the Declaration of Independence and its proposition that all men were created equal and endowed with inalienable rights of life, liberty, and property. In other words, abolitionist Republicans insisted that federalism allowed the northern states to adopt policies on freedom, and that same principle obligated the federal government to conform its actions with the Due Process Clause and oppose slavery in the territories. Lincoln made this point over and over again in his speeches and debates. The same federalism that allowed the southern states to maintain the institution of slavery also protected the rights of the northern states to embrace abolition. Prior to this lunch, I was walking along these walls and looking at these different different placards and different events in Lincoln's life. And you'll find a letter, again, under the 1860 placard, I think halfway down on the wall, where he's writing a letter to a constituent making exactly this point, that it was the position of the Republican Party that states would be left to themselves when it came to policies regarding slavery. Now you know why that was such an important principle to Republicans. It protected the development of abolitionism in the northern states and allowed it to grow. Now look again at the Republican platform of 1860. Let's take another look at those words. Resolved that the maintenance of the principles promulgated in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the federal Constitution. That all men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that the federal constitution, the rights of the states, and the union of the states must and shall be preserved. And that the normal condition of the territory of the United States is that of freedom. That as our Republican fathers, when they had abolished slavery in all our national territory, the Northwest Ordinance, ordained that no person should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. This platform is a remarkable combination of the Declaration, the Bill of Rights, and American constitutional federalism. Now, of course, to Republicans, this combination was not remarkable at all. These were bedrock principles that they believed the people had committed themselves to when they ratified the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. To slaveholding southern states, of course, the principles of federalism and freedom were completely unacceptable. And when Lincoln and the Republicans prevailed in the election of 1860, the southern states seceded. In his first inaugural, a speech drafted at the desk, which is directly behind me here, Lincoln addressed the southern states, and he warned, "In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not mine, is a momentous issue of civil war. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies." But war came. And that brings us to federalism and Reconstruction. Now, you might think that the Union victory in the Civil War represented an end to constitutional federalism and states' rights. And that's how the Civil War is sometimes portrayed. And there is substantial evidence that that's how some Republicans actually viewed the matter. Radical Republicans like Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens believed that southern states had committed political suicide and that the federal government was fully empowered to end slavery and rule over the southern states like conquered territories. And had that view prevailed, of course, we would never have received the 13th Amendment. Lincoln himself claimed no such power, either for himself or for the national government. Lincoln led his party in calling for the addition of a 13th Amendment, forever abolishing slavery throughout the United States. Lincoln had no interest in theories of state suicide. One of his last official acts was to give recognition to Louisiana's reconstructed government. It was an act that allowed him to count Louisiana's recent vote to ratify the 13th Amendment. He also encouraged the Louisiana government to give freedmen the right to vote. According to Lincoln, if the former rebel states like Louisiana had not been allowed to vote on the 13th Amendment, then the ratification of that amendment would be questionable and would be persistently questioned. To the dismay of radical Republicans, the former states of the Confederacy were, in fact, allowed to vote on the amendment, and their votes were counted when Secretary of State Seward announced the ratification of the 13th Amendment. And in this way, constitutional reconstruction thus began with an act of federalism. A new amendment added by way of the federalist process of state-by-state ratification. And that brings us finally to the 14th Amendment. Now, although many of the southern states ratified the 13th Amendment, they refused to grant the freedmen the status of equal citizenship, and instead, they passed the Black Codes, which denied southern black Americans equal rights and the protection of life, liberty, and property. Radical Republicans insisted that the Black Codes could be invalidated by passing federal legislation, like the 1866 Civil Rights Act. The source of congressional power to pass this kind of statute, however, wasn't clear. Some Republicans claimed that Section 2 of the 13th Amendment authorized broad civil rights legislation. Others cited the Republican Guarantee Clause. A House sponsor of the act, James Wilson, claimed that the Civil Rights Act enforced the rights of due process and that Congress had full authority to enforce the Bill of Rights against the states. And that's where John Bingham comes in. Bingham, a moderate Republican, agreed with the goal of enforcing the Bill of Rights against the states, and he agreed that the rights of due process were natural rights which belong to all persons and that no state government should be allowed to deny any person their equal rights of life, liberty, and property. The problem was, insisted Bingham, the federal government was a government of limited enumerated powers. The original Federalist Constitution did not give Congress any authority to enforce the Bill of Rights against the states. As Bingham put it, the enforcement of the Bill of Rights, touching the life, liberty, and property of every citizen in the Republic within every organized state of the Union, is of the reserved powers of the states. Who can doubt this conclusion? Who considers the words of the Constitution, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people? I am with him in an earnest desire to have the Bill of Rights in your Constitution enforced everywhere, but I ask that it be enforced in accordance with the Constitution of my country. This speech reveals John Bingham as one of the most principled members of the 39th Congress. Bingham agreed that Congress should have power to enforce the provisions of the Bill of Rights against the states, but he also insisted that the constitutional principles of federalism and the 10th Amendment precluded the exercise of any such power prior to the adoption of a new constitutional amendment. Radical Republicans dismissed both federalism and the need to pass new constitutional amendments. Bingham embraced the principles of federalism and therefore demanded the addition of a new amendment. Bingham's final draft of Section 1 specifically granted Congress power to protect the rights of citizenship and the equal right of all persons to the protection of their lives, liberty, and property. When added to Section 5, this gave Congress the power to pass civil rights legislation. Once again, the amendment was sent to the states for ratification. Once again, it was sent to every state in the Union, including the former states of the Confederacy. And once again, it would not become a part of our fundamental law unless it satisfied Article 5's requirement that 3/4 of the states voted in favor of its ratification. That ratification was not at all assured. In fact, the provisional southern state governments at first refused to ratify the 14th Amendment, and by the early months of 1867, it wasn't clear that the 14th Amendment was going to receive enough votes to secure ratification. And by this point, radical Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens had had enough of constitutional federalism. Stevens, therefore, proposed a bill that would establish permanent federal control over the former rebel states. Congress would require those states to pass civil rights legislation as a condition for readmission. And if those states ever tried to repeal civil rights legislation, Congress would simply kick them out of the Union. Congress needed no enumerated authority for such legislation, Stevens insisted, since the southern states had committed suicide and the national government was not limited to any specifically enumerated power, not after a war. It was at this point that John Bingham stepped up and saved the 14th Amendment. as well as American federalism. Speaking in opposition to Stephen's bill, Bingham declared, "Sir, I am not to be thus driven into a violation of the letter and spirit of the Constitution of the country. Under it, the rights of the states are as sacred as those of the nation. Its express provision is that, once again, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The equality of the states and the equality of men in the rights of persons before the law is what the Constitution, the post-Civil War Constitution, enjoins and the people demand." Bingham's argument prevailed. Congress rejected Stephen's nationalist proposal. Instead, they moved forward in a renewed attempt to secure the passage of the 14th Amendment. With Bingham's support, Congress passed the Reconstruction Acts, and those acts organized the registration of loyal voters in the former rebel states, not just the registration of loyal white Southerners, but black freedmen also were to be registered and given the opportunity to vote on new state governments and new state constitutions, and the strategy worked. Thousands of freedmen registered and voted to create new state governments under new state constitutions. Those new governments then held new votes on the 14th Amendment, and so it came to pass that Lincoln's vision was fulfilled. Loyal Americans in the southern states, white and black, voted to ratify the 14th Amendment. And in South Carolina, freedmen voted themselves into office, and the state that started the Civil War ratified the 14th Amendment by way of a vote from a majority black legislative assembly. That vote has to be one of the greatest moments in our constitutional history. In conclusion, all of this came about because of moderate Republican commitment to both freedom and constitutional federalism. And today it might seem odd to hear the words of the 10th Amendment being proclaimed by one of the drafters of the 14th. But in fact, it would be odd if a Republican like Bingham had not maintained his commitment to Madisonian federalism. Antebellum Republicans had relied on that federalism to further the cause of freedom in the northern states. Now, truly, some aspects of the original Constitution had radically changed. Slavery had been found irreconcilable with the North's commitment to the Declaration of Independence and the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. The Fifth Amendment itself, along with the rest of the Bill of Rights, was no longer viewed as something just binding the federal government. It took on new meaning in the eyes of abolitionist Republicans, and it now represented the enumerated rights of all Americans, rights that no government, state or federal, could legitimately refuse to protect. From now on, the federal government would have expanded federal power to enforce these fundamental rights of American citizenship. But expanded power is not unlimited power. Lincoln Republicans continued to embrace constitutional federalism and limited national authority as a foundational element in constitutional liberty. Henceforth, Congress had the power to enforce the equal rights of due process and the rights of national citizenship, but the 10th Amendment survived the Civil War. All non-enumerated subjects remained under the control of the people in the states as part of their retained right to self-government. Federalism, freedom, and the 14th Amendment, I'd like to think Lincoln would have approved. Thank you. Congratulations to the Federalist Society for 40 years. I remember when that used to seem like a long time to me. the hair used to be different. I would welcome a general conversation about Abraham Lincoln, the 14th Amendment, the Constitution, anything except privileges or immunities, really. whatever you'd like to do. Yes, please.
So are you suggesting that Lincoln thought the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional from the get-go, just in the other direction?
Sorry, are you suggesting that Lincoln and Frederick Douglass both regarded the Missouri Compromise or any federal legislation prohibiting slavery in the territories allowing slavery in the territories would have violated the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause?
Yes, I think so. Of course, the Missouri Compromise happened decades before Lincoln.
Can you use a microphone?
Oh, Yeah, so the question is, if in fact the Republicans believed that the Due Process Clause obligated the federal government to prohibit slavery in the territories, then what about the Missouri Compromise, which of course permitted slavery, you know, south of the line? And although that argument was not raised at the time of the Missouri Compromise, really the big arguments at that time were resistance to the idea that slavery could be banned anywhere in the territories. But I think by the time, once you move through the Liberty Party and the Free Soil Party and then ultimately into the Republican Party, I think they had developed a theory of the Due Process Clause, which came out of arguments that abolitionists had been making for some time, Lysander Spooner and Joel Tiffany and others. And I think they had come to the conclusion that if you are attentive to the text of the Fifth Amendment, the Constitution is tilted towards freedom. And that, in fact, if you take it seriously, no person in any jurisdiction under the control of the United States should be subject to slavery. And so, therefore, no surprise that one of the first things, as the senator has pointed out, one of the first things that Republicans did as you entered into the Civil War was to ban slavery in the territories. They banned slavery, they ignored Dred Scott. They banned slavery in the territories out west, and they also banned slavery in the District of Columbia. So, yeah, I think they had worked their way to that position. Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you.
There you go.
Yeah, great. I was wondering, obviously, history changed at the end of Lincoln's tenure. How do you think the interplay of Reconstruction and the Reconstruction Amendments would have continued had Lincoln survived to the end of his second term?
Right. God, how many books, right, have been written pondering that particular idea? You do have a nascent conflict developing between Lincoln and the more radical side of the Republicans. That, you know, the arguments over the 10% plan, they were quite critical of Lincoln's decision to recognize Louisiana. They didn't think that there were enough loyal citizens in that state to justify that type of recognition. And so if that's any hint, right, and again, we don't know, but if that's the kind of hint as to what his policies were going to be, then he was going to be moving far more aggressively in the direction of recognizing and recombining the Union. And in that would have shared that particular policy of Andrew Johnson, who also was moving in that direction. On the other hand, the thing that Lincoln did not live to see is something that I think was also referenced in the panel this morning. He got to see the passage of the 13th Amendment, but he did not live to see its ratification. And so I can only presume that he and the other Republicans were hopeful that once slavery had been erased, that the status of citizenship would automatically apply. It was Republican doctrine at this point that you were a citizen of the United States if you were born on the soil of the United States. It hadn't been announced. It wasn't in the Constitution. And we didn't have the 14th Amendment yet. But their presumption was that, you know, in common law, that's just how it should be. So once you got rid of slavery, once the freedmen no longer had the status of slaves, they would automatically become citizens in the states in which they were residing. And if they were citizens within the state that they were residing, the expectation was they would have the equal rights of citizens. They wouldn't be denizens. They wouldn't be a second class. They'd be full citizens. So Lincoln's expectation would have been that the black codes were not going to be passed, right? That the freedmen would, in fact, have a chance to develop themselves economically and become a political power within the South. And if he had lived to see the black codes that were instead passed by the Southern states, it might have radicalized Lincoln. And he might have found himself far less Andrew Johnson, a little bit more Thaddeus Stevens. So that's what makes that makes the question difficult, because they were still hopeful that there could be some type of equal rights for the freedmen, and he didn't see that failure, and we don't know how he would have reacted to it. Oh, yeah, sure.
So obviously the 14th Amendment by its terms applies to the government. During the Reconstruction era, was there any consideration about whether the amendment could or should target private discrimination?
That, again, a huge subject of considerable scholarship. You have the Supreme Court saying that you have a state action, you know, requirement for the 14th Amendment. 13th Amendment, of course, you know, binds both private and government actors and prohibits presumably badges and incidents of slavery, and that has become in legislation in terms of real estate transactions and contract. But then in terms of the 14th Amendment, you have that opening statement, no state shall make or enforce, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, or deny any person the equal protection of the laws. And it's that last one that I think opens the door to consideration about private action interfering with individual rights. Mississippi professor Chris Green has done substantial scholarship on the idea that the Equal Protection Clause is there to guarantee the protection of the freedmen and their basic natural rights of life, liberty, or property, and that if the states failed to adequately protect those rights, then that would justify federal intervention in the passage of new civil rights acts that would punish conspiracies by private actors to interfere with the constitutional rights of the freedmen. I think Chris is onto something. I think that we've not developed that side of the Equal Protection Clause, and I think that's where I would look for protection against private action. I'm going to let you make the decision about who to hand it. You know, so you, no, I defer.
Your wisdom. I'm curious about the insurrection clause and how it came about. Was it a political negotiation in order to get the rest of the amendment through Congress, or was it seen as crucial for the actual effect of carrying out?
You know, I'm still getting used to calling it the insurrection clause, right? You know, that idea that you were disabled from holding office if you had taken an oath to support the Constitution. We could throw the language on there. They didn't want the Republic. That clause was there. It was also one of the most difficult clauses to finalize into language in all the debates over the sections of the Fifth Amendment. The original Section 3, the original insurrection clause that the Joint Committee had put together, disenfranchised anyone who had participated in the Confederacy until the elections of 1870, you know, something like that, and that was completely rejected, and they reworked it. But the theory behind it is that you didn't want traitors coming back in and preventing the development of Reconstruction policy that should be in the hands of those who had won the Civil War, and that concern about those traitors coming back and taking over Congress is actually reflected in a variety of provisions in the 14th Amendment, not just in the Insurrection Clause. It's also in Section 2. The 13th Amendment created an enormous problem. You know, one of the greatest moments in the advancement of individual liberty in the history of the United States, but it also did something else. Under the original Constitution, apportionment, getting a seat in the House of Representatives, depended upon your population of free people, three-fifths of those who are not free, so that's the three-fifth bump, right, that the slaveholding states got, that increased the representation in the House of Representatives, and because representation in the House also goes to electoral votes, the Electoral College, it also gave them greater political power in the election of presidents. Okay, so you pass the 13th Amendment. Now you've got 4 million, three-fifths counts transformed into 4 million, five-fifths counts. It was altogether possible that the ironic impact of the 13th Amendment was going to be increased by losing the war, they'd win, right? Due to their increased political power. So that becomes Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, which, if you read the history, it's quite clear. Section 2 was considered the most important clause in the 14th Amendment. We rarely think about it at all. But what Section 2 does is that it reduces by a proportional amount your representation in the House of Representatives to the degree that you deny the vote to otherwise qualified males within the state. So if you deny the freedmen the right to vote, you're not going to get that political bump. That section was added to prevent that that increase of political power that would have completely disabled Congress from coming to any type of legislative protective action for the freedmen in the South. So you had that, and then you have the insurrection clause once again to disenfranchise that group from coming back in and representing, holding political power, unless Congress votes to remove the disability, you know, by a vote. So all that's what was going on there. That's where their considerations were. It was all tied to the particular aftermath of the Civil War. I think it takes it a second to kick in. I'm not sure.
Thank you, Professor. One thing I'm interested in, you discussed, obviously, there were problems with particular states at this time. How does the 14th Amendment augment or entrench the equal footing doctrine? Does that still have any basis today?
Are we in Shelby County? Are you talking about Chief Justice Roberts' opinion and voting rights and things along those lines?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. That's a heck... I say this to my students all the time. It used to be when I was a young law professor, you know, there couldn't be any question that you didn't know. You know, it was a matter of pride. So you would dance, you know, you'd make something up, you know, like you knew the answer. More and more, the older I get, you know, they ask questions like that. I said, I just don't know. I don't know. Gosh, what do you think? What we do know, one of the things that I'm committed to in terms of my scholarship, the voice that I bring to this national conversation about the history of the 14th Amendment is the voice that you just saw in this presentation, that federalism was far more strongly representative in Republican constitutional theory than has previously been recognized, that this was not a destruction of federalism, this was driven by federalism. And so you see those statements by John Bingham. It's just one statement. I'm not going to build a whole constitutional theory, you know, in terms of voting rights and covered districts and, you know, and things like that. But you certainly have to recognize that this idea of the equality of the states and a concern by moderate Republicans that the Southern states not be reduced to second-class stateship, I guess would be the kind of term, that no, the rebuilding of the Union, the reunification of the Union, had to treat those states with equal dignity and respect as required by the 10th Amendment and the entire federalist structure of the Constitution. Now, the radical Republicans just wouldn't have agreed with that. They would have kept the Southern states under federal oversight forever. And so it's going to turn into a discussion. And I haven't done the work in terms of how the voting rights are going to work and how long-term oversight would work in terms of the equal state, equal footing doctrine. But what I do know is that those articles and those essays who have dismissed the idea of the equal states doctrine that Chief Justice John Roberts talked about in Shelby County, the people who dismiss that as some type of backwards Confederacy-oriented theory are simply wrong. No. That idea is represented in Republican constitutional theory. I'm just not sure how exactly it would play out. Well, there we go. Well, now we can finish our lunch. Is there one more? Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. An absolute pleasure.